This is a presentation by retired surgeon turned peace activist Dr. David Halpin at the Make Wars History Conference. He's describing a set of slides, and if you'd like to see them, they're available at BBC5.tv. It's the video of him giving the whole presentation. One look at the slides should confirm that it's actually nothing to do with the British Broadcasting Company, because the truth is too unvarnished for any of their material. It's just an independent website that happens to be called BBC5.tv.
I'm going to speak about the fertile ground for the seed of evil. In other words, how do wars get going? Why do they succeed? Why do we march to war? And the first thing, and the most important, I think, or one of the important things, is the Y chromosome, the male. There have been exceptions. There was Grace O'Malley, who was a fighting Irish queen, who certainly did fight, and also had children as well, in 16th century Ireland. There was Madame Thatcher, who was certainly, the leaderine was certainly a warrior, and of course we have Mrs. Livni, who in Israel. We have a gullible and ill-informed citizenry. We have the Afghan invasion and occupation, but there is no attempt to ask why the UK is there. You hear the mantra on Spotlight Southwest as they bring yet another Marine home in a box about him sacrificing his life for his country. There is no mention of hydrocarbon reserves in the Caspian Basin or of its long frontier with Iran. Another feature of the human is that many are barbaric, racist, or supremacist. These characteristics were demonstrated in the Shoah, the Holocaust, promised by the Deputy Defence Minister, Matan Vilnai, 1 year ago. And this started with the bombing and shelling of Gaza on the 27th of December. There were something like 200 people killed, I think, in the first 15 minutes. 92% of the Israeli population has approved of this Shoah by poll. Religious belief in one's own rightness and righteousness, the rifle in one hand, the Bible in the other. Supremacist, exclusive closeness as seen currently in Palestine. And then there's another feature, the other, a potent driver of aggression against other humans separated by language or skin pigment. Now, so that's what they can work on. What is the source of evil? And in this brief part, I will in fact row parallel with my friend Chris Coverdale. We have perverted and unaccountable governments. We have greed for natural resources, and this is something which people don't consider very often. And through the possession of those natural resources, we can control competing powers. So this is a big reason, the main reason really probably, why there is, who knows what PNAC is? PNAC. Hands up. One. God, how many? There's about six or seven I can see through my rather high-powered specs. Project of the New American Century. They're halfway there, actually, but it must be read, and it is chilling. But what it requires is the domination of land, sea, air, space, and cyberspace by the USA. The military-industrial complexes were first spoken of by Eisenhower, I think. And then the last, I think probably the most important in this country, is the illusory democracies or elected dictatorships, as in this country. I have no question about it, and I say it without any hesitation. I'm going to speak now about the Third Reich as an example of how they got it going, the machine for war. Fear. There were four things. Fear, the post-Reichstag fire, Do tell me if I'm making the microphone bump. Post Reichstag fire. This was a false flag operation, it was shown to be later on. And with that came the attrition of laws and liberties, and there was fear with that. Patriotism. The fatherland of the Third Reich, we can easily equate with the homeland of the USA. It's being used here now, that term, that word. Saluting the stars and stripes daily in many US homes. Oft-repeated words, democracy and freedom. Combine this with solemn commemoration of sacrifice every November. Mr. Blair standing there with his head bowed at the cenotaph. Racism and supremacism. The invention of the Aryan race above the Jew and the Pole and the Slav. God. This is Hitler. The Aryan stands firm, one with God in his attitude to the world and its people. The Holy Bible was quoted over 500 times in Mein Kampf. There may be some echoes in the Third Reich, or from the Third Reich. Pearl Harbor, 9/11. Mr. Cheney, within 10 days of taking office, said they needed a Pearl Harbor. Did you know that? Sweaty promenaders waving the butcher's apron and singing, Britain never, never shall be slaves. The war on Islam demonized as terrorists when we have terrorized, slaughtered and maimed hundreds of thousands of them. Priests of the Christian churches with their surplices and scarves giving the sacraments at altars in the Iraqi deserts. The cross of St. George chalked on the tanks. How disgusting. Given the apocalyptic nature of modern weapons and the massive array of them, think of the French and British nuclear arms subs colliding, 16 Trident missiles, 4 warheads apiece, and each warhead 8 times the power of the Hiroshima bomb. Is it likely that Homo sapiens, or non-sapiens as I call us, will disappear in a global holocaust? For instance, the lawless entity, the Zionist entity, and I mean that, is screaming for an attack on Iraq, on Iran. It is pretty well armed to do that, and it has over 200 nuclear weapons and the delivery systems to go with them. It is so aggressive and irrational, it is quite possible it could use part of that arsenal in attacking Iran. Will mankind be forever warlike? Many will say with a shrug, 'twas ever thus. Let's go on, put up with it. Others with more conscience will say, I feel powerless. And that angers me. So do we assume that the wars of the Congo, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Gaza will become other wars stretching inevitably into infinity or to that global holocaust? Modern bombing and missile war in living areas kills about 100 civilians to every combatant. Chris was alluding to that. Killing, shredding, and burning is achieved with ease. So is torturing and raping. That goes with war. That's why it's called the supreme war crime, aggressive war, in the Nuremberg Principles, because all other crimes lead from it. Is this to be our world, a world of war, when so much needs our ingenuity, application, and love? Or do we cleave to the other paradigm, to the life-enhancing instead of the life-denying? I believe, and it might be especially true for poorer people, that the dominant image is of the mother with her baby on the breast. This symbolizes peace, warmth, security, and unconditional love. So we have two images in conflict, two paradigms, the warrior and all that goes with that, and the mother and her child. So now some slides, I've got it in that thing. I'll show some slides now, and then I'll speak a little more, and I'll finish with a few more slides at the end with one or two links for you. This picture was taken in the Nakba 60 years ago, when 800,000 Palestinians were driven by terror and by force of arms from their homes, their life and their living in Palestine. No doubt she's a grandma or even a great-grandma comforting her child. This is Mohammed, who was born at a checkpoint about a year ago. The mother was delayed going through a checkpoint in the West Bank, and they wouldn't let an ambulance go through the checkpoint. So someone called for a mattress, and she had her baby in the cold night air by the checkpoint. But happily, the child is fit and well. That is a girlie I reported on in 2004. She was struck by shrapnel in the northern part of Gaza, and the shrapnel entered her right hip, traveled upwards across her abdomen, and into her left sacral joint. She had a permanent colostomy, and the sciatic nerve in her right leg was destroyed completely. So this girl, if she survived, will have had a withered, insensate leg. There's all sorts of shrapnel they use. We can go into that, but I'm not talking about that. I'm just showing just a few instances of what man is doing to man. This was a year ago, and was probably a missile strike from a unmanned aerial vehicle. I'll show you one later, an American version. And it might have been a thermobaric weapon, which I've also written about, which you'll find on my website. I couldn't find any pictures of mothers and babies without, they're all copyrighted, interestingly. We have three lovely granddaughters. This is Isabel, who was then 10, with the new baby, little Delilah. This is what drives me and what I love, and the idea of any one child being harmed, I find totally abhorrent. Oh, this is the predator drone. I'll refer to this in a minute when I get back onto my text. That's an American weapon, but the Israelis actually manufacture them and sell them to China and Turkey, other places as well. But they are sometimes for surveillance, big globe in the bottom with very powerful lens. But they also have missiles in them as well sometimes, in fact quite often. You see a little girl there. Remember there was a shelling on the beach, which they said was an accident. She lost about, I think, 7 members of her family. Here she is crying in desolation on the beach in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. That, I think, is in Gaza. That is in the West Bank at a checkpoint. So girls wanting to go to their secondary school actually ended up having their lessons in the street. But you'll find with me, I hope, the abhorrence of seeing a machine gun pointed at young women. This is the mentality I was talking about. These are two dispatchers on the SS Eisenhower at the start of the Iraq War. You see the Joker has got a death mask on. Do you see that? Nice, isn't it? That's the sort of people that draw on the bombs, you know, to whatever it is. They had some very nasty messages during the invasion of Afghanistan. This is a boy I wrote about called Saad, S-A-A-D. It means happiness in Arabic. And he was in the street. A missile was released, probably again a thermobaric missile, from a drone, so-called. Two men who were just by him were killed immediately. Another two men were taken to hospital, and they died as they went into El Shifa Hospital. And Saad survived, but all the muscle was blasted off his right thigh. And had other things as well. He had a colostomy too, and had a drain in his lung, because the blast often causes a hemothorax, or they sometimes have viscera, like the liver or spleen, damaged by the blast. So they come in bled out, and they're opened up and wanting to be done for them. I'm just giving you some idea of the vile, the devilish ingenuity of mankind. This is a famous child called Fares, who threw a stone at a tank. Actually, it's the rear end of a tank, but it gives you some idea of what vehicles they are. That is a converted, it's an American tank, Abrams. It's been converted, and it's called a Merkava tank, and Israelis have 3,500 of them. 3 days later, the sniper split his head open with a bullet. So he's one of those little heroes in Gaza. This is where it happened in 2002. Boy, I think he knew he was going to die, actually, they say. That's Isabel again with little Delilah. Two little girls from the recent... the attacks have been cyclical. I've been there most often when they've been happening, actually. But this was a tremendous convulsion of explosive force and the rest of it. As you know, with something like 1,400 people being killed, these are two little sisters who were obviously in the morgue, judging by the vehicle. This looks like an old mask, doesn't it? This was in a year ago in Gaza, with another convulsion, a smaller one. This just reminds me of the beauty of our world. This is a view from our woodland, Zion Coombe, which we've kept. We've planted many trees, and in fact, I can see hay tall from there where we live now. But this is the world we should be enjoying, loving, celebrating. We shouldn't have to be talking about tax strikes or whatever. And as a retired orthopedic and trauma surgeon, you work quite hard, very hard really. I'd like to be enjoying my retirement and finding time to spend a day in the woods every fortnight. The rest of the time I'm writing about morbid things, because we have the most revolting leaders in this country and in some other Western countries, in fact, most of the European countries actually. And that's an autumn scene through our woods through some Norway maple. I think we'll leave that on, and I'll just put that down. Now, can you hear me? Yes. What I'd like to speak of now, fairly shortly, is what we can do in the longer run, feedback. Upbringing. This is key, I think. The child needs the love of both parents and love within the family circle. This is very prominent, actually, in Islam. When I go to Gaza, I love being with families because they are very close together, contrary to some of the propaganda which is constantly being squirted out from our state broadcasting corporation. I was fortunate to have been the eldest of four and to have had a mother who loved babies. I like talking about this, but men never do they? I saw her breastfeeding my baby brothers, Michael and Peter, and caring for them in all ways. I think all those things, like she used to knit, like all mothers used to knit, all lots of little dainty garments with lace edges. And I think my love of babies and the tenderness I feel for most people derives from that. Not all people, I will readily admit. These defects in upbringing are changing, I know that. The male role in caring for the child and cherishing it is vital for the little one and to enhance the tender feelings in the father too. The stereotype was instead a father who had little embrace of the infant and who was himself packed off to a prep boarding school at 7 for the wealthier families. Later he would go to a public school, which I think John Pilger has said are schools for killers, officer class killers. Does university entrance enhance, sorry, does university enhance humanity in an individual? I don't know, actually. I think that clever dicks might be cold fish. Education, another very important fact. I think our education is absolutely dismal in these things that we're talking about. History is biased, often grossly, and I doubt the human elements like suffering and loss come across when they're talking about war. I don't know. Civics, or whatever you might call it. Are human rights taught in depth? Interestingly, in Palestine, the United Nations, the UNRWA schools, teach human rights. It's a very important thing there. Are the laws of warfare, even the essence of what Chris has been speaking about, taught? Or talking of peace? Now, the milieu, what we grow up in, and this is the memetics bit amongst other things I've been speaking of, shallow celebrity and shows of aggressiveness diminish the value of the individual. The poor, the pigmented, the far away are of naught. Dispensable. 27 persons, including militants, were killed Wednesday in Lashkargah by an airstrike. Gone. And there isn't a thought in this population about the people who've died and who they were, who was married to who, how many children there were, as Chris has been saying. But that's what it's like. You hear it every few days. Now, the spectrum of sensitivity and conscientiousness of people who want to do good as against those who relish evil or who will be complicit with it. It was, I was on a march in autumn 2002, marching against the Gulf War, I think it was against the Gulf War then, before the US and the UK, courtesy of Mr. Blair, laid upon Iraq like wolves, to quote Galloway. We were swinging down Haymarket. A middle-aged male with green blazer and polished shoes and a woman on his arm. If it was left to me, I would nuke the lot of them, I heard him say. If it was left to me, I'd nuke the lot of them. Chill and anger ran down me. I broke off and followed the nuker up the pavement. I tapped him on the shoulder. Would you please repeat what you said back there? F off! With hatred in his eyes, for one of the thousands who stood against the wall. At the other end of the spectrum, that man Wilson, you may remember him, whose nursing sister daughter Marie was blown to pieces in Iddiskillin Remembrance Service bombing. He forgave the bombers without reservation, and his radiant goodness was exemplary for all. In between, many shades of sensitivity and conscientiousness, but there are masses of people who want to work, obviously, worry about their mortgage, and particularly now, and so many are wage slaves, and join 80,000 others at a rugby or soccer match. But let someone else react to mass murder abroad. It's not to concern them. So the clowns and circuses are very important for this fascist government. So celebrity come dancing involves 20 million people, supposing, looking at it, and the Olympics are all. What to do now? The media is absolutely central, and it has to be changed. I can't see it happening easily because they have it by the throat, the people who control it, or sidelined, like, for instance, we're thinking of giving up our TV license when it runs out. The BBC is a major servant of government and thus for war, and you probably know that before the Iraq War, it was calculated that they only gave 3% of broadcasting time over to people who opposed the war. And they gave endless time to Mrs. Pearl, Edelman, Wolfowitz, all sorts of Zyokons and others who came over here telling us how important it was to have the war. We must inform ourselves. We must root out evil politicians and embrace the good. I'm getting more impressed with my MP. He's been very helpful about the ramming of our boat. Not that the FCO have been helpful. A good example is locally. I wish Mr. Steen was here, because I like speaking about people directly to them. But I remember at a meeting at in the Great Hall, he was asked why the Tory party voted for the Iraq War. And he said, well, the Labour were good to us when we went into the Falklands. So in other words, if you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, and we'll have a war over it. That's what we call logic, and in fact it makes Chris's point completely. Direct, non-violent action. Now there's a certain hypocrisy in me here, because I would find it hard to do it. I'm a very law-abiding citizen. But that, I think it's very important indeed. And the three instances I'll give you, one was a recent one. Some very excellent people in Brighton have been doing their best to prevent the manufacture of bomb release mechanisms by EDO. It's an American-owned firm, I think. And that these are installed in F-16s and other planes, but they certainly go to Israel, and they're used to release missiles and bombs. They're not meant to go to Israel. It's in fact meant to be a ban on all such weapons systems going to Israel. But as always, our government is very good at turning a blind eye to these things, although it signs these various agreements. In the first half of last year, we sold 28 million quid's worth of stuff to Israel. And from knowing how they behave, they shouldn't in fact have a match. The B-52 bomber was attacked at Fairford by, I think, three people. I'm not sure whether it's still in the windings of the courts, but the law that they used was that they were committing a small crime to prevent a bigger crime, and by Jove they were. And finally, Raytheon in Northern Ireland, nine people got in there and disabled their computers. Excellent. The most important thing of all, and I really mean this, is to indict criminal leaders. And I'm going to show you something now. Some next slides. Sorry about the microphone, the volume changing. Right. Who's seen that image before? Chris has. I guess I've shown it before. There's about 10 people here. I'm not going to apologize for showing. I think it's one of the most terrible images. I got it. Someone sent it to me. I never knew who sent it. So I wanted it I was writing an essay. You'll find it on several of my essays about Blair. But this is Ali Abbas. I'm showing it so we can feel the... Isn't it terrible what we've been doing? Terrible. And we're so remote from it The bloody BBC won't be telling about this. They've never shown his image. Ali Abbas, this was 10 days into the shock and awe, which Mr. Bush was so pleased about, and this lad was asleep just after midday, just after midnight, when there were two booms. He heard them, actually. This happened to him. I'm quite certain, actually, it was due to intense thermal radiation from a thermonuclear device, which no one's talking about. No one has come to me and said, "You're right, Alpin." They don't, you know, there's no comment. Silence. I get silence all the time in my work. But it's remarkable how his head and neck and his legs are preserved. The burn across his trunk was an inch deep, and you can see that his arms are incinerated. The other one was just like this, with his phalanxes showing white out of the black. His mum and dad were incinerated, and ten other relatives. Mr. Blair, Mr. Bush, and the rest of the cabals should be in court on this boy alone. They made a big fuss about bringing him here and trying to give him artificial limbs, which were always useless. There's nothing like the hands that God gives us. And he's been over here, he's a great soccer player, but he of course has to have an uncle hold his willy when he's having a wee or when he's having to have his bottom wiped. For life. And that is the boy. As I said last time when I showed this, he's saying, "What have you done to me? And will you be doing it to other people?" That's my website. If you just put in, there's some things there which will interest you and will take you deeper, perhaps. It's not an advertising exercise. I just want to share my pain and my knowledge with you. But if you just put in if you have a computer, the website of David Halpin, then you'll get it. Don't have to worry about the formula. This is a very important quote. I've just extracted parts from it, and I have, in fact, photocopied 10 at the back, if you would like the full quote. It's from a man called, as you see at the bottom, Milton Mayer. "They thought they were free, the Germans, 38 to 45. We'll just read that through for those people who can't see it easily. I've just taken bits of it. It provided an excuse not to think for people who did not want to think anyway. This is entirely apposite to the time now. When I used to say we've reached 1939, I think we've reached 1941. I think so. But this is why, and I send it to people, and almost everyone says, "I agree with you, David. This is a very important quotation." Or, "I'd like to read the book, but I never have time." "By the machinations of the national enemies..." National enemies, you see, enemies, always make an enemy, very important, "without and within, do you see, watch those fundamentalists, stop them on the motorway, going to Galloway's thing, stop them, search them, get the imam, do a body search on his wife and on him, back in Bolton or somewhere, that we had no time to think about these dreadful things that were growing little by little all around us. One no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. Now you live in a world of hate and fear. You have accepted things you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things your father could never have imagined." This was December the 9th in Canada, and you see that it's a very high resolution photograph, and you see behind Blair and Faith. It's the Blair Faith Foundation.
Do you know what year it was, David?
What?
Do you know what year it was?
Last year. It's 2 months ago.
Really?
Yeah, 2 months ago. He pops all over the world. He come like a jack in a box. Colony Hotel, £750,000 a year for his apartment there as envoy for the quartet. down to Sharm el-Sheikh for a bit of politicking over the Atlantic, and here he is now in Canada with a lady called Mrs. Stronach, who was opening it. She was part of some association there. You see, what I'm showing it for is that this is the face of a hypocrite. Hypocrite, in fact, is derived, those Greek scholars here will know, I'm not a Greek scholar, but it comes from the word actor. He's an actor. But he's worse than that, actually, he's a psychopath, like so many of his ilk, because he's grinning like a Cheshire cat, and yet he has helped to put to death 1.2 million people in Iraq. He's done nothing at all to stop the killing in Palestine, and he's maimed at least 2 million people in Iraq. Again, about at least a third of them will be children. And you remember there's in fact 4 million displaced. That's like having 12 million in this country refugees. 2 million inside the country, 2 million out. And that's just for starters. And we needn't start discussing Sierra Leone and Yugoslavia and what went on there. So that's the man. But I think that's why I show it, is the look of confident. A look of confidence and happiness on his face. Extraordinary, isn't it? Oh, yes. Something else, actually. No, missed it. We have set up a foundation called the Blair War Crimes Foundation, and I urge you to sign. It's not a petition, it's to register your support for it. There should have been a link for it, but not to worry. It's not always a way to remember these things, but the Blair War Crimes Foundation. And our purpose is to get him into a court. That's what it's about. Most people say, oh, that'll never happen. Well, they've got Lubunga in International Criminal Court at the moment for abusing children in the Congo. They can do that. You tell me why they shouldn't get Blair in there. So, to finish, we should know the sanctity of life. We should cherish all children everywhere. And we compete and die, or cooperate and live and be joyful. Thank you.
David Halpin talks about petrochemical reserves. That speech was made before the announcement that the US made recently that Afghanistan may contain up to $1 trillion in mineral deposits. The last recording we have today is from the Make Wars History UK Parliamentary Select Committee, and this is introduced with a piece on the legal status of the war in Iraq under existing anti-war law.
What I originally intended to do was to cover four areas. Firstly, the illegal nature of the wars with Iraq and Afghanistan. Secondly, the war crimes that have been committed. Thirdly, I want to single out the offenders, that's Britain's war criminals. And lastly, I want to outline what we can do to stop the killing. I expect to take about 20 minutes, so we'll get on with things after that, but there will be a few opportunity for questions. So just to summarise what has happened. Firstly, on October the 7th, 2001, Tony Blair informed the British people that we were at war with Afghanistan, and we were using submarine-launched missiles to attack Kabul. We've been fighting there ever since. And we have now killed at least 50,000 totally innocent Afghan civilians. The second thing is, on March the 18th, 2003, Parliament voted for the war and took the illegal decision to invade and occupy Iraq. The war led to the destruction of Iraq and the deaths of at least 1 million Iraqis, including 300,000 children. Now, it's those two facts, in a sense, that stimulate the need for something to happen in Parliament to get things moving. These two massacres are, without doubt, the worst atrocities in British history. You go back over history, You will never find another occasion when we have killed 300,000 children. Now, when you kill somebody because of their nationality, in law, that's a crime of genocide. And what I want to make quite absolutely clear tonight is that the British government and our leaders have been committing genocide in both Afghanistan and Iraq ever since we went in there on those 2 days. Now, shortly before the war with Iraq, the Prime Minister and the Attorney General assured Parliament that the war with Iraq would be legal, on the grounds that it had been authorised by the Security Council. That claim is totally false. Not only is it false, it is deceptive and misleading. Now, I want to go through some of the evidence to show you why that is the case. The memorandum to Parliament from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office claimed, and I quote, "The legal basis for any military action against Iraq would be the authorization which the Security Council, by its resolution 678, gave to member states to use all necessary means to restore international peace and security in the area. That authorization was suspended but not terminated by Security Council resolution 687 and revived by Security Council resolution 1441. Now, it's on the basis of that statement that we have murdered 1 million people. And I want to make absolutely clear that it is false in a number of different ways, in at least 6 ways. Firstly, the UN is for peacekeeping, not war-making. It is forbidden from using armed force. Article 41 of the UN Charter states quite clearly, the Security Council may decide what measures not involving the use of armed force are to be employed to give effect to its decisions. Now, that couldn't be clearer. Number two, Security Council resolutions are the operating objectives of the Security Council. They are not the law, and they do not apply to states operating without Security Council authorization. The UN Charter is the law, and it states, states must settle their international disputes by peaceful means, and they are forbidden from, quote, the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. That is the law. Number four, resolution 678 referred to the expulsion of Iraqi forces from Kuwait in 1991. And it ceased to apply when Iraq was forced out and a ceasefire was agreed. Five, the Security Council had just rejected the infamous second resolution put forward by Britain and America and had refused to authorize the use of armed force. Resolution 1441 gave Iraq a chance to prove that it had complied with its disarmament obligations. It did not authorize the revival of Resolution 678, which is what the government informed us and Parliament. So those are 6 reasons why that legal advice was false. Now let's turn to the deceptions in the Attorney General's advice. The reason it is deceptive is that because it fails to mention the laws of war. If a lawyer is asked for legal advice on the use of armed force and his advice fails to mention the principal laws and prohibitions that govern its use, he is negligent and culpable in law for the consequences. Of the 10 main war laws omitted from the advice, I want to mention just 4 tonight. The others are listed in the pack that given out. The first is the Treaty for the Renunciation of War. Now, this is the single most important law the world has ever signed. 63 nations signed up and promised never to go to war again. I can't find a single member of the government or parliament who knew about, or knows about now, the Treaty for the Renunciation of War. I find that horrific. And it picks up Elvin's point that people do not know the laws of war. It's known as the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And it renounced war and promised to settle all future disputes peacefully. It's important because it was the first treaty outlawing war, and it formed the legal basis for the Nuremberg war crimes trials in 1946, at which Germany's leaders were convicted of 11 breaches of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. The second is the UN Charter. Now this is, as everybody knows, the most important, the premier war law, in which Britain and all the 192 member states agreed never to threaten or attack another state, to settle all disputes peacefully, to respect human rights, to uphold the law, and to act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood and cooperation. And we signed that. The third is the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. This was signed in 1998. 108 nations have ratified it, and it sets up the world's first permanent criminal court in The Hague. This court has ultimate jurisdiction over the universal crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and conduct ancillary to such crimes. So that's six international offences which you can be charged with and tried at The Hague, and I hope it's going to work. The fourth and last one that I want to bring out tonight is the International Criminal Court Act 2001. Now this should really have been called the Genocide, Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, but it wasn't, and that is a mistake, so nobody understands that that is what it is about. It is the ratification of the International Criminal Court and the introduction of those crimes into British, English criminal law, English and Welsh criminal law. There was also the International Criminal Court Scotland Act, which applies to Scotland. So, that's a very brief summary of the laws of war. You'll find the other ones mentioned in the documentation. So let's move on and ask why the government's legal advice was misleading. Not only was it deceptive, but it was thoroughly misleading. Because the Attorney General failed to inform all those taking part in the war of the personal consequences of breaching war law. He failed to point out that any resident of Britain who takes part in an illegal war of aggression bears full responsibility in law for the consequences. He should have pointed out that if one or more Iraqi citizens suffer injury or death at the hands of coalition armed forces, then everyone involved, whether or not they were present at the time of death, is criminally liable under the doctrine of joint enterprise for genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, crime against peace, murder, incitement to murder, and conspiracy to murder. Let's move on to the second area, the war crimes. What actually happened? When coalition forces invaded Iraq, they used modern, indiscriminate, high-explosive weapons of mass destruction, such as cruise missiles, rockets, cluster bombs, mortars, and depleted uranium shells against villages, towns, and cities throughout Iraq, killing and injuring thousands of men, women, and children. Not one of our victims had done anything to harm or attack us. Not one was allowed to plead for their lives in court. Not one was shown any mercy before they suffered cruel and painful death. This massacre of men, women, and children, as I said, is the worst atrocity in history. Never before have we killed so many people solely because of their nationality. In law, killing people because of their nationality is a crime of genocide. Let me briefly explain the legal definition of genocide. Genocide, quote, means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. As such, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And there are two other criteria that are not relevant in this situation. The legislation then goes on to specify the four elements of the crime that must be in place before a court can convict a person for genocide by killing. And they are, one, the perpetrator killed one or more persons. So it is possible to commit genocide and only kill one person. Two, such person or persons belong to a particular national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Three, the perpetrator intended to destroy, in whole or in part, that national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. And four, the conduct took place in the context of a manifest pattern of similar conduct directed against that group, or was conduct that could itself effect such destruction. Principle underlying the criminal law doctrine of joint enterprise is that when a gang or group assaults or murders a victim, even those members who do not physically participate or strike the fatal blow, but simply lend encouragement, assistance, or approval to the crime, are as guilty as the chief perpetrator and will receive similar prison sentences. By taking part in the unlawful armed attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq, Britain's political, civil, and military leaders aided and abetted the genocide of the Iraqi and Afghan people, and all of them are criminally liable to be tried, indicted, and punished as principal offenders under sections 51 and 52 of the International Criminal Court Act and Article 25 of the Rome Statute. That summarizes the issue, in a sense. Let's move on to the third point. Who is responsible for the crimes? Who are Britain's main war criminals? The main responsibility for the wars with Iraq and Afghanistan obviously lies with George Bush, Tony Blair, Barack Obama, and Gordon Brown. But there are several thousand others in Britain who took a leading part in the planning and conduct of the war and are responsible in law for the consequences. They include the Queen as Commander-in-Chief, all members of the Cabinet, the law officers, all government ministers, every MP who has served in Parliament since October the 7th, 2001, every member of the House of Lords, including the law lords and the bishops, staff and advisers at number 10, civil servants in the main government departments, particularly the MOD, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the Cabinet Office, and the Prime Minister's Office, Armed Forces commanders and senior military commanders. All of these people could at any time have said, no, we're not going to go ahead with this. But they have gone along with it for 8 years. Also, High Court and County Court judges and magistrates, the Metropolitan Police Commissioners and Chief Constables, the DPPs, two of them, and the Crown Prosecution Service. Also, directors and managers of companies and banks supplying funds and arms for the war. Journalists, editors, TV and radio presenters, and members of the media. And finally, taxpayers. Now, all of those people are groups of people who have taken part in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, I know this comes as a bit hard to people, but I want to provide important legal information for everyone who finds themselves unwittingly on the list and wants to avoid prosecution. The Rome Statute is aware of these issues and contains a very important clause. It reads, a person who abandons the effort to commit the crime or otherwise prevents the completion of the crime shall not be liable for punishment under this statute for the attempt to commit that crime if that person completely and voluntarily gave up the criminal purpose. Now, we need to be quite clear what completely and voluntarily means. I think this is important because an awful lot of people were deceived into going to war, as Paul has just been saying. A lot of MPs were deceived over this. No one knew these laws existed, but they did. And people were not informed about them, and they were misinformed and deceived. So if you're one of the people who wants to avoid prosecution as a war criminal, you must take remedial action immediately to prove to any future court that you have abandoned all the activities associated with the crimes and have completely involuntarily given up the criminal purpose. So what does this mean? I'll just go through five things that, if you do them, it will count well for you if you're ever brought to court. The first is to report the war crimes to police. When you observe a crime taking place in this country, we all have a duty to report the crime to the police so they can investigate it and stop it. So I would recommend people start to report these crimes to the police, local police and the Scotland Yard. You should also join the tax rebellion. An important point is that it is a criminal offence to provide the financial means for the commission of a crime. And that applies to genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes in particular. So the legislators of the Rome Statute and the International Criminal Court, when thinking about this, laid it out very clearly, you must not finance a crime. So what you need to do is to arrange for your taxes and any corporation taxes and anything else to be paid into an escrow account and withheld from the government until the killing has stopped, the war with Afghanistan has ended, and criminal proceedings against war criminals have begun. It's a very simple thing to do. Now, you're not actually refusing to pay tax. What you are doing is steering your tax into a court so that it will only get used when the government is acting lawfully. And that's a very powerful way of stopping this government. And if we can get a national tax strike going, and if MPs can persuade, can get the military appropriations put into an escrow account, the war will stop within a week. The third thing is to contact your MP. Obviously, this isn't the... Well, they want to do so as well. Pointing out that they're violating the laws of war and must act now if they are to avoid prosecution. We need to approach all our MPs, tell them about the laws of war, what the implications are for them as individuals, and ask them to sign early day motions. One of the things I hope the all-party parliamentary group will be able to do is to put forward some pretty tough early day motions to bring an end to the killing, to recall the troops and to initiate prosecutions. You can also remind your MPs that they're working for you, not for Gordon Brown, David Cameron, Nick Clegg, or any political party. Unless they act immediately to end the killing, you can tell them you will never vote for them again and ensure that they aren't sent to court for their crimes. You still catch me napping
one day and that's it for this week. For those of you with feedback, suggestions for the show or other communication, there's a mailing list at altruists, that's altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.